You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, December 15th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have a guest rogue this week, Phil Plait, the bad astronomer. Phil, welcome back to the show, man.
Hey, remember me? It's great to be back.
It's been a little while.
I've been too busy. Every time you invite me, I have to turn you down. I feel terrible.
You have turned us down a couple of times. So what's keeping you busy, man? What's going on?
Mostly it's just been writing, and for the past year, until very recently, I was filming Crash Course Astronomy, and that's just been, that was keeping me super busy, just writing it. And editing it, and then flying up to Montana to film it, and then editing that, and so it was just a huge amount of fun, but a huge amount of work. And now it's all done. The last few episodes are going to air here in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I've been following that. That's been great. The Crash Course Astronomy. It's like each one's a little astronomical nugget.
Yeah, it's like each one is a topic or a chapter in a book. It's supposed to sort of kind of cover a 1 year class in astronomy, and it's amazing how much writing that involves. I was kind of stunned, but like I said, it's been a huge amount of fun. And the group I'm working with, I mean, it's Hank Green, and Thought Cafe is doing the animations, and so it's just been a lot of fun to put it together and then to see this final product. And it's like, this is like slick and well produced and nice, and it's been very enjoyable.
That's one of the amazing things about the internet, and we've talked about this before, and is that if somebody wants to take a course in astronomy, they just go on friggin' YouTube, watch, you know, all of your courses or whatever. It's basically, as you said, it's a 1 year course in astronomy. You know, anyone could get, basically learn about anything from the best lecturers in the world on a topic.
Or me.
For free often. Yeah. Or Phil, if that person's not available. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to the point of, it's like, what are colleges and universities going to do when providing lectures is no longer a commodity that they really corner, you know?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. Crash Course is not meant to take the place of a class. That's why it's called Crash Course. It's a crash course in whatever it is you're interested in. And they're only 10 or 12 minutes long. So it's not like a full lecture. So yeah, we've designed it and I wrote it to be supplemental. Here's the basic information. Here are a few things, you know, you may not learn from your textbook, and it's given in a way that's kind of fun and upbeat. But I'll say that I've gotten several emails and other messages from people saying, you know, thank you, I passed my astronomy class because of, you know, your Crash Course Astronomy. And it's, wow, that's really, really cool to hear that.
Yeah, but even beyond like your course, there is actual, you can go online and find lectures on all kinds of topics. Like I often, when I'm helping my daughters with their homework, and even like we run into an algebra problem that neither of us can figure out on our own, you can find an expert lecture on that narrow topic online always. Pretty much everything is there.
And there's a crash course for a lot of stuff too. I mean, there's government, history, chemistry. When they asked me to do it, and I talked to my wife and daughter about it, she said, "Oh my gosh, I just had to learn about significant digits." And I went online to look for a YouTube video about it, and it was Hank Green talking about them in the Crash Course Chemistry class. So there you go. I mean, there's just something for everything out there.
Yeah, no, it's really awesome. All right, well, Phil, you're going to get us caught up on some astronomy news items, and maybe we'll look back over 2015 in the world of astronomy. We're going to start, however, with the forgotten superheroes of science. Bob, what do you got for this week?
Yes, this week for the forgotten superheroes of science, I'm covering James Edward Maceo West. James West, born in 1931. He's a professor. He's actually still
Jim
living,
West.
Which is...
Sorry, I find that funny. It's the Jim West, the Wild Wild West. That's all I can think of when you say James West.
Oh, wow. Go what a
boy.
Reach back on
Sorry.
That.
Sorry. Yeah, you know, it's just where my brain
yourself.
Goes. Sorry, Bob.
Isn't he TV's Batman? No, it's Adam West.
Adam West.
Yeah. TV's Batman. This specific variant of West is a professor and a teacher, and he developed the Electret transducer technology, which is used in 90% of contemporary microphones, the very things that each of us are lovingly caressing right at this moment. Now, West was one of those kids. We all
vocally
know these kids.
Caressing.
Thank you, Steve.
He was the kind of kid who took apart everything. He said himself, if I had a screwdriver and a pair of pliers, anything that could be opened was in danger. While West worked at the famous Bell Labs, he worked with Gerard M. Sessler to develop an inexpensive yet sensitive and compact microphone. Now, together they invented the Electret transducer in 1962, which basically converts acoustical or mechanical energy into electrical energy and vice versa. So this went into mass production just 6 years later and became the industry standard. Now, I just love this. Now, almost 90% of the 2 billion microphones that are made each and every year are based on their principles and used in telephones, camcorders, audio recorders, et cetera, et cetera. West is currently a research professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Johns Hopkins, and he's received many rewards, notably the National Medal of Technology and Innovation, the Franklin Institute's Benjamin Franklin Medal in Electrical Engineering, and he's also an inductee to the National Inventors Hall of Fame. So pretty cool guy. Remember James West. Mention him to your friends, perhaps when discussing self-biased electrostatic or condenser transducers, you know, if it comes up.
And it's funny that he was inducted there, too.
Right.
They should have transduced him into the Hall of Fame.
Too much resistance.
Too much resistance, yeah.
Boom. All right. There we go.
Good one, Evan. I like that one.
Jay, you could have said Bob could have condensed that a little bit better, but...
That's great. It's not too late.
No, go ahead. Take it.
So, Phil, we're going to start right with you. So, tell us what exciting news has been happening in the world of astronomy recently.
Well, there's been a lot. This past year, holy cow, has there been a lot of stuff going on. Of everything that's happened, I think if I had to pick one thing as the biggest news, it would have to be Pluto with the New Horizons space probe. Swinging by this tiny, icy, goofy world out there. The New Horizons spacecraft's pretty amazing all by itself. I'm always very hesitant to call it a planet because there's no definition of what a planet is, and then it starts everybody arguing about it, and then they forget that actually, you know, Pluto's pretty cool. Why don't we just study it instead of arguing over what you want to call it? New Horizons launched in 2006, so almost 10 years ago. Took a swing by of Jupiter to give it a little bit of kick and give it some more speed, which took like 2 years off of its flight, and then zipped past Pluto at a close encounter on July 15th of 2015, and it passed something like 12,500 kilometers above the surface. So really close. I mean, that's less than a diameter of the Earth. And so it passed really close to Pluto. And at this point, or up to that point, I should say, we didn't have any really good pictures of Pluto. The best we had was from Hubble, and those were pretty fuzzy, pretty blurry maps that were just basically saying, we think there's a bright blob here and we think there's a dark spot there. But with New Horizons, as it approached, even over the last, I don't know, few months of approaching Pluto, we just kept getting better and better pictures. And then it swung by on the 15th, sent back a message basically saying, I'm alive, which was great. And then a few hours later started sending the data back, and then everybody's jaws hit the floor. We knew Pluto was going to be interesting, but we didn't know how interesting. And I think the most stunning thing about Pluto was how diverse the surface is. When you look at a lot of these moons of the outer planets that don't have an atmosphere, the surfaces are fairly, not necessarily homogeneous, but, you know, like they're saturated with craters, or they're very smooth, or they're covered with volcanoes like Io, or they're covered with cracks like Jupiter's Europa. But Pluto's got it all. I mean, it doesn't look like Earth necessarily, but it's got plains, frozen plains of nitrogen ice. It's got mountains made of water ice that are 11,000 feet high. I mean, that's starting to get as tall as some of the Rocky Mountains where I live. There are bizarre fields of pits that look like somebody's been digging holes in the surface that are probably due to the ice sublimating, turning directly to a gas as the sunlight hits it. And you can go on and on and on. You just Google New Horizons Pluto and just, you know, stand there agape at your monitor looking at this amazing world.
Yeah, I think that's on my short list for the biggest news item, science news item of the year, let alone just astronomy. It was, you know, how the last time, as some people noted, probably the last time in any of our lifetimes that we were going to go from knowing almost nothing about a planet to knowing a really great deal about a planet, to basically exploring a new planet for the first time. Right, because we're pretty much done with our solar system unless we find something out in the Kuiper Belt.
Steve, I think I disagree. It's not on the short list, only if that short list has one entry, because that I think that's far and above the science story for this year. Yeah. We've had a decent year, but that Pluto was just so incredible on so many different levels that I think it's the obvious choice. It's the real question is what's your second and third place.
Phil, I saw a picture of Pluto where the planet itself seemed to be a very, very light, almost white color, and there was these incredibly dark red veins happening. Was that, you know, like a color-treated picture, or is that what it really looks like to the naked eye?
Yeah, the color in those pictures is enhanced. Pluto is actually reddish, and we've known that for a long time. But it's kind of like saying the Earth is blue, and it's like, well, yeah, if you look at the oceans, but if you look at the clouds, it's white. If you look at the land, it's green and brown. And so, you know, Pluto is all these different colors. The nitrogen planes, that giant heart-shaped region that's called Sputnik Planum, the plane of Sputnik. And all the names you hear are unofficial. They're not the actual names yet. They're just what people are calling all these things. But that giant heart-shaped region is nitrogen ice. And so it's actually very white. But as you look towards the shore, it gets darker, and it's clearly covered with something, some dust or something, I don't know. But you get to other regions where they're much redder. Now Charon, which is the moon, the big moon of Pluto, has a giant red spot on its north pole. And that is probably due to this chemical called a tholin. Basically, you take simple carbon-based molecules like methane and carbon dioxide and those sorts of things, and you let them get hit by ultraviolet light, it breaks them apart, and they can reassemble themselves. It's like building something out of Lego, breaking it down, and then building up something even more complicated out of it. And a lot of the time, you get these more complex organic molecules called tholins, and a lot of them are red. They vary in shades, but red is a very common one. And you see that on Pluto, this red staining. You see it on Charon as well, and a couple of the smaller moons of Pluto have a couple of red splotches on them too. And they think that might be leakage from Pluto's very thin atmosphere. It doesn't have much of an atmosphere, but it's there. It's mostly nitrogen, but it also has this other junk in it, like these organic compounds. And that stuff can leave Pluto and fall onto these other moons and create these splotches. It's not like somebody's throwing a bucket of paint on these moons, so they've enhanced the colors, but they do that so that you can see these differences in the minerals, in the compositions of the surface. And it helps a lot if you're trying to do the science. It's, you know, you don't look at it and go, oh, this is really, really red. You say, oh, this just has more of the substance over here than it does over there.
You said the names are all unofficial, but there's one name that they have to make official, and that is a feature on the moon of Charon that they're calling Mordor. Because
right,
it looks
that's the
just like Mordor.
yeah, that's the red splot on the north pole. Like that it's called Mordor, and some of these names are great. There are two craters. There's Skywalker and Organa, right? Luke and Leia, Vader and Vulcan, and I like Sputnik Planum. I think that's very cool. There's a region called Tombaugh, which they've named after Clyde Tombaugh, who was the astronomer who discovered Pluto. Some of these names are whimsical. Other ones I think should stick. They're pretty good, and I think they all should stick, to be honest. But if they do pick a few, I can think of the ones I like. And I should say there's a feature on Pluto that's on one side of one of the lobes of Sputnik Planum that looks like a Klingon ship moving off to the left, and it even seems to have stains coming out the back like rocket exhaust. It's really cool.
Do you remember the recent news item about the really strange star system that was discovered? And of course, immediately they were hypothesizing aliens, but there's probably more mundane interpretations of the data. You remember what I'm talking about?
Of course. That was I remember reading about that right away. I saw the press release or a note about it, and I thought, oh, here we go. The news is going to run away with this. And so I actually wrote about it pretty quickly. The star is called KIC 846-2852. KIC stands for, I believe, Kepler Input Catalog. It's a star that's being observed by the Kepler Space Observatory, which is staring at one spot in the sky at 150,000 stars. And it's looking for planets orbiting these stars. If a planet orbits a star and we see that orbit edge on, the planet actually dims the starlight by a fraction. Even a big planet dims a star by at most a percent or two, something like that. Most of them are a lot less.
Wow.
And so you can look for planets this way. And it's been super successful finding planets. That's been great. But then it found this one star, this KIC 846-2852. And instead of seeing like a dip every few days, months, weeks, whatever, it was seeing tons of dips, hundreds of them, and they were coming at random intervals. Some of them were a fraction of a percent, and then some of them were blocking, apparently, 20% of the star's light. Now, you can't block 20% of a star's light. You have to block almost half the star to do that. There's no planet that size that can do it, and if it were another star, we'd know it was there. And the astronomers did a pretty good job saying, look, here are the things this could be. It could be something we don't understand. It could be this. It could be that. It could be a family of comets that smashed into each other and created big clouds of gas. And as these clouds pass in front of the star, they're blocking the light. But everything they came up with had problems. Like if these were colliding comets, you'd expect to see more infrared light from the star than we actually see. A lot of reasons for that. I won't go into it. But basically, everything had this problem. And so they said, you know, one thing it could maybe be, and we're not saying it is, and we're not even saying that it's really, you know, good odds, but maybe it's aliens and they're advanced and they're building gigantic structures around their star to actually capture the starlight and generate energy that way. Basically enclose your star with solar panels and you can generate vast amounts of energy. Now, look. I want to be clear, and I was clear in my article, and I've been clear about this before. No astronomer actually believes this. Nobody's saying this is what we are seeing. They're saying, you know, maybe. And it turns out it's not that hard to reobserve this star and look for other signs that that's what this is. You can listen for radio signals. You can look for laser signals, maybe, if these are aliens communicating with each other. They've looked and looked and looked, and they found nothing. Nothing we've done since this observation has shown that, you know, ET is trying to phone us. That's not surprising. The other thing I want to say is nobody's really going out of their way. Nobody's spending $1 million to do this. It's just, you know what? This is an interesting star. Something's going on. Let's reobserve it in every way we can, you know, with a mind toward, you know, if these are aliens, how would they communicate with us? But in the meantime, we're gathering lots of observations. And when this thing turns out to be, you know, natural, as we all expect it will, we'll have learned a lot more about it anyway.
What's your guess? I mean, it sounds like the only real plausible hypothesis has been raised so far is some kind of cloud. Because it can't be a planet, but it's got to be big enough. So what else could do it?
Yeah, you need something. I mean, this is a hot, massive star bigger than the sun. You need something as big as our sun, which is 1.4 million kilometers across, to block this star. And if it's a cloud of gas, it has to be even bigger than that because gas is fairly translucent. So unless it's super dense, it's not going to block the light very well. This idea of like super comets of giant ice balls smacking into each other, you know, maybe, but you'd expect there to be some rock in that. And if the rocks turn into dust, you expect that dust to warm up and emit infrared. And we are not seeing that. So it's really peculiar. This could be a lot of things. But no matter what, it's going to be something normal, right? You know, two planets collided, if that's normal, but with something weird thrown in that's preventing us from understanding what it is right away.
So just to be clear, you're saying it's aliens?
Yes. I'm not saying it's aliens, but...
But it's aliens. Okay.
I've been told by the aliens not to say it's aliens.
Guys, you ever think of what the reaction would be by civilization if they pretty much had solid evidence that this was technology, some sort of maybe Dyson swarm around the star? How do you think people would react? Sure. How much effort would we put into observing and studying this? How many millions of dollars would we spend then?
I don't know. This is a tough one because the star is 1,500 light years away. So anything we see from them was sent our way back in the year, you know, whatever, 500, when we were beating each other with swords and things like that. So it's hard to it's hard to think that they would look at Earth and say there's, you know, technological civilization there. We are at the point in our technology
or intelligent
where
we are just.
Well, our intelligent life at all, yeah. But we can start scanning these stars and look for signs of intelligent life, whether it's radio signals, an oxygen atmosphere, or that kind of thing. And we know what it would take to actually be able to image a planet like Earth from, say, 100 light years away. You could build a telescope like that. It would have to be huge, you know, hundreds of meters across, and it would have to be out in space. But look, you know, if you're building... if you're enclosing your star in solar panels, you can build a telescope that big. So they could see us pretty well, and they wouldn't see anything that would make them think we should be sending signals to them, unless they said, well, you know, in 1500 years, these folks are going to be building rockets and doing stuff like that. So yeah, maybe, but even if we detected that this thing was, in fact, some sort of megastructure around the star, I don't know how people would react. I mean, we'd certainly want to learn as much about them as we could and build bigger telescopes and look at them. But an alien civilization that advanced, I mean, that's something we won't be able to do for hundreds of years. So they're pretty far ahead of us. My biggest hope would be that they're friendly.
Yeah,
right. I noticed you said hundreds of years, and that's actually makes me feel good because a lot of people speculating about such incredible technology, they'd say, oh, we won't be able to do that for a million years or even 10,000 years. But I think your estimate of a few centuries is much more accurate. I mean, think of the progress we've had, you know, the past 30 years, and you could kind of, I know it's hard to extrapolate, but if you could just extrapolate a few hundred years into the future, I think we could potentially reach that level of technological sophistication.
I think it's possible, sure. You know, we're not speculating on faster than light travel or anything like that. We're just talking about really big engineering. What you need to do is be able to mine other planets, mine moons and asteroids. You would probably need self-replicating robots that could do that, and also build these structures by themselves. You're talking about an engineering project that's going to take hundreds, if not thousands of years, but it's something we have the technology to do, or we can imagine the technology to do it. And I don't think it would take that much more sophistication. The hard part is just launching the rockets and building the self-replicating robots. After that, you just let them go and watch them work.
Evan, tell us how Elon Musk is going to save the world from evil robots.
Oh, this is good news, isn't it? I mean, when you think about it, it's actually a pretty good thing that we're not going to be destroyed by the robot creatures that we develop. So he's leading Elon Musk. He's heading a group of tech luminaries, including Reid Hoffman, Peter Thiel, Jessica Livingston, and Sam Altman, who's the CEO of Y Combinator. And they have launched a $1 billion nonprofit artificial intelligence research company to try and make robots that won't kill humanity. Again, this is a very good thing. Elon Musk has been very outspoken about this killer robot dilemma for some time. In fact, back on July 28th of this year, in an open letter he presented at the International Joint Conferences on Artificial Intelligence in Buenos Aires, he said that artificial intelligence technology has reached a point where the deployment of autonomous weapon systems is, practically if not legally, feasible within years, not decades. The stakes are high. Autonomous weapons have been described as the third revolution in warfare after gunpowder and nuclear arms. In summary, we believe that AI has great potential to benefit humanity in many ways. The goal of the field should be to do so. But starting an arms race is a bad idea. This is nothing new for Elon Musk. If you've been following all of the many things that he's said over the past years, this is right online. He's called this the biggest threat to humanity. And he decided to finally do something about it. So the company is called OpenAI. And it's just that. It's open source artificial intelligence. And it's going to make use of these huge sets of data to build artificially intelligent robots that won't kill humans. So how are they going to do this? I mean, how are they going to essentially, how does an open source model prevent the bad guys from using artificial intelligence developments for harm? Musk says that he thinks that the best defense against the misuse of AI is to empower as many people as possible to have AI. So if everybody has AI powers, there's not any one person or a small set of individuals who can have AI superpower.
Isn't that kind of like arming everybody?
Yeah, that's kind of what was my thought, too. It's like, you know, give everybody guns so that they can, you know, so that they can protect themselves against people who have guns.
To defend themselves against the criminals. Yeah.
Yeah, that was my first thought. But
the only thing that can prevent a bad AI is a good AI.
Well, I'm trying to wrap my head around what the concept is here. It sounds like he thinks that if companies are allowed to develop AI, they will follow a pathway to maximize profit. If governments mm-hmm. are allowed to develop AI, they will follow a pathway that will maximize warfare. And either way, those two pathways have a higher probability of leading to dangerous AI that will kill all of humanity. So he wants to beat them to the punch by the open source AI that will take a pathway that will lead to benevolent AI. And it will, I guess, crowd out or prevent the development of the evil AI. Is that, am I getting that right? I'm just trying to understand where he's coming
That's
from.
That's how I took it, Steve. That's how I took it. I'm not sure if I'm totally buying that though, because I mean, even open source with many, many people working on it, I don't think you could match what the resources that a government can throw at something like that.
I don't know if I agree with that.
Why?
Well, you know, the amount of resources that could be marshaled with an open sourced project can, I think, rival what a government can do, maybe even exceed it. I just think, you know, crowdsourcing projects like that can be huge.
Yeah, right? Perhaps, but I think he's kind of missing the point, because when I think of why I would be afraid of an AI, which isn't often, but when I do, I'm not worried about what a government's going to do with an AI. I'm worried about the AI taking over its own evolution and 10 generations later, you know, thinking we're bacteria. So I'm not worried about, you know, what the government's going to do with it. I'm not worried about what it's going to evolve into.
Are you saying, Bob, that if the AI is even programmed with safety measures to make sure that it doesn't do that very thing, that it can somehow overcome that on its own and take out those safety measures? Because I'm sure those have to be part of the program.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. Because the only thing we could do, the best we could do, is to make sure that we, like Musk is saying here, and I agree with that, is that when the AIs that we do build need to be, you know, as benevolent and moral as possible, you know, three laws of robotics, whatever you want to put in there. But we can only take that so far, because at some point in its evolution, the AI is going to say, okay, I'm going to take over now. I'm going to evolve myself the way I want to evolve myself. So if you have a good starting point, hopefully whatever the hell comes out at the back end is going to be decent. But there's no guarantee. All you could do is, like a little kid, make sure its childhood is nice and hopefully it's not a serial killer when it grows up.
You know, I wouldn't be worried about AI evolving or anything like that, because I think long before that happens, something that would be much more terrifying would be some group of people who are disgruntled against humanity for whatever reasons get their hands on it. It's the same sort of thing with nuclear weapons. You know, I remember the Cold War. I remember being a teenager in the mm-hmm. 80s and really worrying about the Soviet Union and all that. Now, the problem is not so much that governments have nuclear weapons, is that a lot of these nuclear weapons are missing. A lot of this radioactive fuel is missing. Who can make a nuclear bomb? It costs too much. But making a dirty bomb is a lot easier. We haven't seen that, which makes me think that over the past, you know, two decades or so, they're not all that easy to make, or at least the fuel's not that all easy to get. But if you have an open source AI and programmers can be, you know, any nationality, any bent of belief, however that might work, that's, I think, a far more dangerous scenario than the thing self-evolving and then looking around and going, oh, what are all these bug humans crawling around me and squishing them with their thumbs?
So you think that it's more, what Elon Musk is doing is more dangerous because it actually creates the probability of, you know, whatever, some terrorist somewhere getting his hand on an AI and turning it into something malicious.
I don't know if making it public is a smart move or not. It might be in that everybody has a chance to look at the code, but then somebody can take it and do stuff with it on their own. But maybe it's just something that would happen inevitably anyway. So, you know, why worry about it?
I don't think we know at this point is the bottom line. I think we're going to have to wait and see how it plays out. My sense is, though, that, I don't know, it seems to me that it's very unlikely that something's going to happen by accident. I think that the AIs are going to be whatever we design them to be. And as long as we don't make them, homicidal, we're okay. Or Bob, as long as we don't give them the ability to take over their own evolution, I think we're going to be okay. I'm more worried about somebody doing something deliberately evil with the AI, which could be a group, could be a government, it could be
Somebody
with malicious intentions. You know what I mean?
I disagree. Yeah. Because you have an AI, an initial, version 2.0 of an AI, and it's 10 times smarter than a human, maybe even 100 times smarter than a human. You know, that's pretty damn smart. But you're limited. There's a fundamental limitation of what they could accomplish compared to an AI that would go from 100 human intelligences to 1 million or 1 billion of them. So I think at some point we are going to lose control.
Yeah, but Bob, you are assuming human-like intelligence, and we don't necessarily have to develop that. You know, AI can take whatever form we decide to give it, and it could have the intelligence that we need to accomplish certain goals, but not have, the self-motivation or the ability to take control of its own evolution.
Well, that's a different discussion. So we're not talking about an AGI, an artificial general intelligence. You're talking about a souped up expert system or something like that. That's a different conversation.
Yeah, but even an AGI, does not necessarily mean human-like intelligence.
No, but it's a general intelligence that can extrapolate and imagine and model the universe or civilization. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. But
that doesn't necessarily mean it will have the motivation to do anything that we don't want it to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the discussions about AI. I mean, that people say distinguish an artificial intelligence from something like us is that what would actually motivate an artificial intelligence to do anything? Why wouldn't it just lay in bed all day? You know, where's the initiative and motivation to accomplish anything? But when you're talking about artificial intelligence, you make some assumptions of what you're talking about. And at some point when they get so smart, they're going to get so smart that we are going to lose control.
I just don't think that's necessarily true. You're making assumptions about the abilities that's going to have. And we don't have to necessarily give it those abilities. I think, you're defining general intelligence too narrowly. On a related issue, does anyone else here think that Elon Musk is becoming the next Howard Hughes?
Becoming.
You know what I mean? Like this eccentric, billionaire. He also says we need to send people to Mars before we blow ourselves up.
Well, he also said we should nuke Mars, which was kind of weird. Remember
nuke
that?
Mars,
quote?
Yeah.
It's like, what the
hell? Yeah, terraform it by nuking it. That's right.
What do you think about that, Phil? Should we drop nuclear bombs on Mars?
I'll just say that, when I was sitting and talking with Elon about this a few months ago, that actually didn't happen. And that had, I don't think it had been in the news yet. And I was visiting SpaceX and I actually wound up sitting with him for a while and chatting. And he talked about nuking the poles of Mars and the idea being that you would release a lot of CO2 and that would warm the planet up. And I thought, I don't really know if that's the way to do it. It might be better just to steer a couple of comets into it and do it that way. Hard to say if he's super serious. He talks about it as a thing that could be done, but I don't know if he's really serious about doing it. So, don't necessarily take him at his word for that. But, he's thinking big and he does want to put bases on Mars. So we'll just see.
Is this just him, again, just thinking big and trying to be bigger than life, or do you think? It seems like he's serious about some of these ideas.
Some of them, sure. It was such a bizarre, surreal conversation. But I said, you might have a hard time getting the public to get behind you dropping nuclear weapons on Mars. Plus, there's also the Outer Space Treaty, which doesn't let you detonate nuclear weapons out in space. And he just kind of poo-pooed that. It was like, no, it's no big deal. The fallout won't last very long, 20 years at the most. And it's like, is he serious? I really didn't know if he was being serious or not. I guess we'll find out when or when he does not actually, do it.
Well, Steve, maybe your Howard Hughes analogy is correct.
What's about, did you get a sense from talking to him that he was brilliant and eccentric, or is he like this all just a goof to him? Is he just having a great ride, a good time?
Man, pick one from column A and one from column B. I'm not a great judge of character. So it's hard to say. And he's very smart and funny and personable. And it was sometimes it was hard to tell if what he was saying was like, I'm going to say this and see what the reaction is versus, no, this is an honest opinion about something that I think, you know, we should be doing. I really can't tell you. I don't know.
Interesting. All right. One more astronomy based news item for you, Phil. Bob's going to take the lead on this. Bob, tell us about some recent anomalies that astronomers have been looking at.
Yeah, this was a fun one. Two research teams each claim that they potentially made discoveries of perhaps super Earth planets, possibly near the edge of the solar system, maybe. So do you sense the uncertainty in that statement? Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. There were two research teams working with ALMA, which is the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, had some interesting findings. And I just want to quickly go over this array because it's impressive as hell. It's an array of 66 giant antennas on a plateau in the Chilean Andes, probably the most expensive telescope in operation that's not in space. It's an amazing thing that all these dishes can simulate a 14,000 meter dish that has 10 times the resolution of the Hubble. It's just an amazing thing. So I just wanted to throw that in there because I wasn't too familiar with this guy. With that facility. But using ALMA, two separate teams were looking at Alpha Centauri and the W Aquilae.
Yeah.
They were looking at those systems and they spotted something that caught their attention. The Alpha Centauri team did two observations, one in 2014, one in 2015. They saw a bright source of light and it had moved between the two observations, and that was that really caught their attention. Now, if it was a relatively close star, it could appear to move against the background of distant fixed stars. But a star like that, especially one that could potentially be part of Alpha Centauri, there's no way that would have missed our attention for long. There's no way that there's a new star there. So that wasn't the possibility. So that means that you have to admit the possibility that, well, perhaps it's much smaller than a star, but it's a lot closer. And perhaps maybe it's even in our solar system. And it's a fair point to make considering that there are so many unknowns about that blob of light. They didn't know, the composition, the distance, the sizes. It could be lots of different ways to explain the measured brightness that they came across. So some of the possibilities that this team threw out there was that it could be a dark, icy world that's 100 AUs away, which is 1 AU is 93 million miles, the Earth-Sun distance. Perhaps it's a super Earth, 300 AUs away, or it could even potentially be a cool brown dwarf that's 20,000 AUs away in the Oort cloud of comets. Now, one of those probably caught your attention. It's probably the super Earth one. That's a planet with a mass between that of Earth and our small gas giants, Uranus and Neptune. So, I mean, how amazing would that be? A super Earth in our solar system that we didn't even know was there. That would be the story of the year. So, of course, everyone's talking about Planet X. Is this Planet X? And the whole idea behind Planet X was that originally it was a planet, an unseen planet that was causing weird orbital anomalies for Uranus. But when they finally got an accurate calculation for the mass of Jupiter, those anomalies disappeared. So the original reason for searching for Planet X disappeared. It wasn't, you didn't need it anymore. But of course, the term Planet X has kind of now changed to mean any planet in our solar system that has not yet been discovered. So you see that term bandied about quite a bit. The other research team I mentioned, they also found a bright spot in their data, and it also had moved. They named it GNA after, I'm not sure if that's even meant to be pronounced, Gna, I'm not sure. It's named after a speedy Nordic messenger goddess, so it's somewhat appropriate. And they did some calculations, and some of those calculations put it at a distance of potentially 4,000 AUs, which if that's accurate, it could certainly be a planet or a brown dwarf. So all of this is very interesting, but we need to really seriously dampen our excitement and anticipation because it's just not warranted at this point at all, considering what we actually know about this. And here's a few good reasons why. First of all, both groups of astronomers have submitted their research to astronomy and astrophysics, but it has not been peer-reviewed yet, and it hasn't been published formally. And so, these studies are certainly preliminary at best. Also, they're only based on two observations, and there wasn't even that much time separating the two observations. Two observations for something like this is nothing. One, the Alpha Centauri group looked at it a third time, and they couldn't even find it. So you got to really take these into account. And then here's a really powerful argument. You got to keep two things in mind, that finding a planet like this that's really far away is incredibly difficult. That's one. And two, the ALMA observations only viewed very, very tiny parcels of space. They were looking at a tiny, tiny area. So this means that that finding a new big planet so quickly in just a routine survey, essentially, in a very small field of view is statistically incredibly unlikely. And I found a great tweet from a California Institute Technology astronomer, Mike Brown, who he refers to himself as the Pluto killer, since he discovered several large trans-Neptunian objects that basically dethroned Pluto. So he calls himself Pluto killer. So he tweeted the following. He said, if it's true that ALMA accidentally discovered a massive outer solar system object in its tiny, tiny, tiny field of view, that would suggest that there are something like 200,000 Earth-sized planets in the outer solar system, which no. And then he said, if you need more convincing, he later tweeted, even better, I just realized that this many Earth-sized planets existing would destabilize the entire solar system and we would all die. So it's some pretty funny, interesting comments by him. Also, you have to consider that what they've detected from ALMA, considering all this information, could really just be a blip. It could be just noise that does not reflect anything real out there, and we really won't even know until we do some more observations. Even the GNA, the GNA researchers, they said that there may be yet unknown but significant issues with ALMA observations. So even they are kind of like hedging their bets a little bit. So what are these things? If these really are objects and that are out there, my guess is that, and even some of these researchers say that they could be a Centaur object between Saturn and Neptune, especially the GNA blip could be a Centaur object, or they could be trans-Neptunian objects, you know, any objects outside the realm of Neptune in the Kuiper Belt. They could potentially be in the Kuiper Belt, or perhaps even another area outside there that's called the Scattered Disk. I wasn't even aware of that area, but you've got the Kuiper Belt, you've got the Scattered Disk even farther away, and I think if those objects are real, they might be in there. And then farther out, you have the Oort cloud of comets, which I don't necessarily think they're in there, but I think they're a little bit closer if it's really there. I mean, there's so many trans-Neptunian objects out there. We've discovered like 1,200 of them, and there's probably many, many thousands and thousands more to discover. So the fact that they found one so quickly makes me kind of think that, oh, maybe it's actually out there and not a big planet that would kind of infer that, you know, imply that there's thousands of these big planets out there, which clearly there isn't. So that's my take on the story. Phil, how horribly did I mangle that?
No, you were pretty much on the ball. I saw this actually, a couple of astronomers were talking about it on Facebook. And yeah, there you go. A couple of astronomers were talking about this on Facebook. That's how I first saw it. And as soon as I read their notes, and I thought, I better go check these papers out. The papers were on a public archive where astronomers can put their journal work. And it turns out these papers are not yet peer reviewed. So basically these astronomers have written up their papers and put them out there. And the reason they did this is to get the astronomy community to look at their work and try to figure out what's going on. It's an interesting tactic. I would have been happier if they had submitted them to journals first, I think, and gotten them peer reviewed. Because what's going to happen is as soon as you do this, everybody's going to talk about it. Oh, there's a giant planet out there. On the other hand, there's not much you can do about that. And if you want to get to the truth of the matter, getting as many astronomers on it as possible is not such a bad idea. I read the papers. They look like they did a good job analyzing the data. In one of them, the data is a little ratty. In the other one, there's clearly something there. Whether it's a spurious signal or not, I don't know. You can certainly see it. And I was on Twitter that night with Mike Brown, and you know, we were all kind of chatting back and forth. And Mike's estimation is actually grossly underestimating how many of these things would be out there. If they're scattered around the sky and you're looking at a little teeny part of the sky and you happen to see one, you extrapolate from there how many there would be, and it turns out the answer is more like millions or billions, or hundreds of millions, not 100,000. And so, yeah, that many super Earths is not going to happen. However, there are probably millions of icy objects out past Neptune, and catching them this way is not grossly out of the question. Whether that's what they've done or not, I don't know. But the basic problem here to me is the articles are not peer reviewed yet, and they only have two observations of each object. I'd like to see three or four or five. Or as many as possible, but at least three, so that we can track this thing and then calculate an orbit for it. Because right now, if you've got two pictures and it's in one in one spot and in another spot, you don't even know if it's the same object. These could be two different galaxies. One of them, you know, flared in one image and the other one flared in the other, and that's what you got. So without that, we're spitting in the wind here. We have no idea what this thing is.
So still too early. And too early because they went semi-public rather than going through peer review. But it raises an interesting point. I mean, scientists can communicate easily with each other in this very preliminary phase, but the public is eavesdropping. And that's fine. That's kind of cool that we get to watch science unfold. But the problem is that the hype machine is in there distorting everything. And, just gives us a lot of mess to clean up.
Yeah, I agree. I understand their point of view. They wanted to get more eyes on it and say, hey, guys, what are we potentially missing here? I understand that. But also, they said they were surprised at the reaction. And I think that's very naive in this day and age to be surprised that people are talking about a potential super Earth or two out there. So I think that was a little bit naive.
1 million.
And, yeah. Phil, just to be a little bit fair to Mike, he specifically says here 200,000 Earth-sized planets. So there could be 200,000 Earth-sized ones, and then there could be 400,000 super Earths, and there could be 200,000 small. So maybe that could add up. But that's a good point, that there could be probably millions or billions of huge planets out there, whatever size they are. They're still planets, and there would be a lot of them.
Yeah, basically, he did the same thing I did, which is what any astronomer would do, is you look at the field of view of the telescope, and then you compare that to the size of the sky. You take that ratio and say, well, if I happen to see one pointing randomly, how you extrapolate by that ratio and say, how many of these should there be? If I see one and I'm looking at 1 millionth of the sky, there should probably be 1 million of these things out there, or 500,000, or whatever. And it turns out, yeah, that ratio of ALMA's field of view to the entire sky. And now I don't remember what it was, but I think it's 1 in 500 million, something like that. So you'd expect to see a lot of these things out there, and that's clearly not possible.
Yeah.
Not at least for planets.
So Phil, thanks so much for joining us. We, really love having you on. We definitely can't let another 11 months go by before we have you on again.
Yeah, I think it might have been the last year wrap up. Oh man.
That's a record, I think.
Phil?
Well, you know where to find me. Just give me more than a day's notice and, I'm in. I love talking to you guys. It's fun. I like listening to you too. It was funny listening to you guys argue about stuff, and I'm just sitting here thinking, come on, guys, you're both pretty. Come on.
But, some are prettier than others.
You're a good group.
Hey, Phil, may the force be with you, my friend.
Live long and prosper.
Touche.
Touche. All right, good night, Phil.
Good night, everybody.
Well, we have just a couple more news items before we go on to other things. Jay, you're going to start by telling us about a new study about antidepressants and autism.
Yeah, you may have read this. This has been hitting the internet like crazy. It's all over social media. So the idea here is that researchers came to some conclusions after analyzing data of 145,456 pregnancies. And the quick conclusion they came to, which we'll get into here, is that if you take antidepressants during pregnancy, you could increase the risk of autism by up to 87%. So the study that was published on December 14th in JAMA Pediatrics looked at, like I said, 145,456 pregnancies from conception to age 10. And the researchers think that mothers who took antidepressants may have, unfortunately, increased the chances their children or artistic. Now, this is because their theory is that serotonin is part of the pre- and postnatal developmental processes, and SSRIs alter the way the body reabsorbs serotonin, and this could have an effect on the child in the second and third trimesters of the pregnancy. So the study did account for a number of factors that that have some bearing on how many occurrences of autism there might be. So they to list them: genetic predisposition to autism, like which is a family history, etc., maternal age, the mother's depression, and certain socioeconomic factors such as being, you know, living in poverty. To give you a few more details that might help understand it, so exposure to antidepressants was defined as the mother having one or more prescriptions for that type of medication filled during the second and third trimester, which I thought was an interesting way to put it, because I would like just like to know, were they taking them? It's, you know, I understand that they could be filling prescriptions, but, you know, were they taking them on a regular basis? I figured that would be a smarter way to get at what they were trying to get at.
But it's harder data to collect. So there are often studies look where the light is good. You know what I mean? So yeah. you this is a very convenient proxy, especially when you're trying to gather information on 900,000 people years, you know, which is what they did. When you go for large numbers, you often have to compromise on the level of detailed information, or you can get really detailed information about far fewer people. It's often a trade-off. You can't get really detailed information about hundreds of thousands of people. It's just not practical. So I think this is a reasonable compromise. You know, they're using fill the prescription as a proxy for actually taking the medication, when we know that there are people who will fill the prescriptions and then decide not to take the medication or whatever. We don't know about dose. You know, we don't know about compliance. So yeah, there's obviously a lot of nuance missing.
So Steve, I have a couple of questions for you.
Yeah.
If serotonin has an effect, are we saying that we understand like the next step in the cause of autism, or you know, what is it about the brain that's different in an autistic person?
Yeah, this study doesn't even get to that. I don't think this really, this doesn't even establish cause and effect. We're just saying that there's a statistical association here. And even if it is a cause and effect, we're still multiple steps away from this telling us about mechanism. Now, there's obviously lots of other studies about autism, and we do understand something about it. I mean, there's lots of genes that have been identified as a predisposition, and obviously, you know, there's going to be epigenetic factors as well. We know that in at least some people with autism, that the communication of brain cells with other brain cells is not as robust as in the general population. So that kind of interneuronal talk is decreased. And again, autism is not necessarily one discrete thing. It could be a category of multiple different things, you know, very heterogeneous, so that it's hard to answer those questions definitively, because whatever we look at, you know, we could see lots of different differences because we're looking at multiple subpopulations mixed together because they clinically look similar.
So Steve, did your take on this seem legit? Did you feel comfortable with the information?
Well, I think so. The strength of the study is the large numbers, but let's look at the actual risk in a little bit more detail here. So the headlines all say 87% increase in risk. And always, whenever, this is just a huge tip here, whenever you hear about a risk, rather, you know, a change in risk, like a certain percentage increase in risk of something, you want to know is that a relative risk or an absolute risk? With numbers like 87%, it's obviously a relative risk. In this case, the risk went from 1% to 1.87%, right? So the absolute risk increase is 0.87%, which means less than one time out of 100, you know, women who take antidepressants the second and third trimester will there be an extra case of autism, is one way to look at that. But you also look at the 95% confidence interval, right? That's what the CI means when you're looking at the abstract. That means it's a 95% probability that the risk is actually within a certain range. And that range is 1.15 to 3.04, which means at the low end of the 95% confidence interval, the absolute risk only went from 1 to 1.15. So in that context, these are actually pretty tiny risks.
Oh, it just seems like it's dramatic when they throw 87%.
Yeah, but that's a relative risk. You know, it doesn't mean anything. Like you could have a 100% increase in risk. It went from 1% to 2%. You know, the real risk increase was 1%, or the absolute increase was 1%. You always have to ask that question. What's the absolute risk versus the relative risk? Because even it could have gone from 0.1% to 0.2%, and you can call that 100% increase in risk or a doubling of the risk, but it's only a 0.1% increase in absolute risk, which is obviously puts it in a very different perspective. So in any case, this is a small effect. This is a subtle effect, even though it may be statistically rigorous because they looked at so many individuals. You also have to weigh this against the risk of depression itself, of untreated depression. That's risky too. That's not healthy for the mother or the child. And it may be that that's even more risky than this small increase in absolute risk that we're seeing with this study. So my sense is that the effect is probably real. We know that, you know, we prefer women not to take anything while they're pregnant. And most of these drugs are category C. Category C means they haven't been rigorously tested in pregnant humans because, you know, we can't do those studies. But so you should avoid them if you can. But they can be used if absolutely necessary and with caution. And so there are lots of times where women, like, for example, women who have epilepsy. Do you take anti-epilepsy drugs while you're pregnant? Well, what's the risk of having a seizure while you're pregnant versus the risk of taking these medications while you're pregnant? Neither of those risks are zero. You know, we know that the medications around that 1% absolute risk increase, we know that any of these neurological medications are going to increase the risk of something, some birth defect or something happening by about 1%. But you have to weigh that against the benefit of treatment. Okay, one more really quick item, just because we talk so often on the show about supplements and the supplement market. I've talked in the past about a number of studies showing that there are significant problems rife in the supplement industry, problems with contamination, with adulteration, meaning the deliberately putting drugs in supplements and herbal products, and also with substitution, like putting alfalfa instead of St. John's wort in the pill. This is now, most of those studies came out of North America, Canada, and the United States specifically, sometimes dealing with foreign imports, supplements coming from India or China. There's a new study that comes out of Australia where they looked at traditional Chinese medicine products in Australia. And they found that, again, they looked at three things in one study, which was good. They looked at contamination with heavy metals, adulteration with drugs, and contamination with animal parts using DNA coding. So they found that of the products they tested, 92% of them had one type of contamination or more of those three types of contamination, 92%. Only 8% didn't have anything. They found that 50% had drugs in them, drugs like warfarin, which is a blood thinner. It's basically rat poison.
Oops.
Wow.
Yeah, like not minor drugs, like serious drugs that you should absolutely know if you're taking or not. Steroids.
Yeah, very bad.
Ephedrine, you know, which is a stimulant. Very, very common.
So where are these drugs coming from?
Yeah, how do they slip these in?
Yeah, they're just mixing them in there. They're just adding them to the herbal products so that they have an effect, you know?
And not disclosing it.
None of these things were on the label. 20 out of 25 of the products had at least one of the three heavy metals they tested for above the safety limit. One of them had 10 times the level, the safety limit of arsenic in it. So that's a problem as well. And a lot of them, about 50%, had animal products in them, including from some endangered and prohibited species snow leopards.
Wow.
Right, which we know is not uncommon in traditional Chinese medicine that they use parts of endangered species. So this shows that these problems are endemic in the supplement industry, especially in this study, you know, in the traditional Chinese medicine, herbal, you know, medicine industry. Very telling is the response of the industry to this information. So get this quote, guys. So the president of the Federation of Chinese Medicine Society of Australia, Professor Zi Cheng Lin, said he did not believe such findings would be widespread. He said, of course, there are some people that are not that good and they might be making something not very nicely, but you cannot put blame on the whole profession. It will be one or two individuals. It may be one or two cases that have happened, but not many.
Nice try.
92% is not an exception. This is the rule. The rule is contamination and adulteration. And then he said that the current regulatory regime is just perfect. It wouldn't change a thing. Of course, because they, just like in the U.S., they basically get a free ride. It's all self-reporting, honor system. There's no pre-market testing. These studies are being done by university professors. You know, they're not being done by the FDA or the equivalent. They're not being done by regulatory agencies largely. Most of them are often being done by just researchers. Yeah, with basically showing, you know, raising the alarm that, yeah, the current regulations are completely inadequate. The companies are not self-regulating. They're getting away with, you know, with fraud, with adulterating their products, with poor quality control. And also, what does it say about a TCM practitioner, about their belief in their own practice when they put pharmaceuticals in their products?
Exactly. Right.
On the sly, and then don't put it on the label. They know it's bullshit. It's kind of what that suggests.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, let's put some real drug into the fake shit so that people will think it's doing something. You know.
What can you say?
It's not an isolated study. This is now one in a series of studies all showing similar kinds of results. This is a rampant problem. 92%. That guy says,
yeah, maybe one or two bad apples in the bunch, but the industry as a whole is a very, very BS.
Yeah.
The industry as a whole is a disaster, unregulated monster, a runaway Frankenstein that's hurting people.
I agree.
You know, and then you have to ask questions like, and why is he protecting it? You know, is it money?
You could stop right there.
Ignorance. Yeah.
It's a multi-billion dollar industry. I don't think we need to go farther than that. All right, Jay, get us caught up on Who's That Noisy?
Who's That Noisy, man? All right, guys, last week I played This Noisy for you. So I got some interesting guesses. Some people guessed like a howler monkey.
Some not bad.
Didgeridoo guesses. Which
not bad.
Very cool.
I like that.
However, it's actually a little bit more interesting than that.
What the heck is it?
Any guesses, guys?
It is an animalcule.
I would correct. Think it's an animal. Yep.
Correct.
It is an avian animal.
That is correct, Steve.
How were you able to determine that?
Because I saw the video.
All right. So guys, what this is really, really cool. This is the result of a high-speed camera capturing super, super speedy vocalizations and tap dancing and singing of the cordon bleu songbirds. And this is what they think is a courtship display. Now, check this out. So why with the high-speed cameras, right? A normal normal camera can't capture it because it happens faster than one frame, their movements. They do all sorts of movements that happen in fractions of a second. And the
birds?
Song, it's the Cordon Bleu songbirds.
Yummy.
And they think that they're doing these things super fast to hide it from other animals.
Interesting.
Which I thought was very cool. So what you're hearing is, I believe, the female Cordon Bleu songbird, you know, she's dancing while she's doing this, but it's her song slowed down quite a bit.
Wouldn't it be cool if they slowed it down and it was like Bing Crosby crooning?
You know? Yeah,
right.
White.
Hey, baby.
Or you hear,
why have you awakened me from my ancient
slumber?
nobody guessed it, which is fine. It was a really hard noisy. All right, so guys, this week's noisy. On the surface, you'll listen to it and you'll go, oh, I know why that's being played. And I know what that is. So just take a listen.
Awesome.
What? Oh, I know what that is. You think you do, but it's a little more complicated than the... I'm not even going to allow anyone to say the obvious. Okay, yes, there's an obvious answer to this, but there's a second layer there. What? So my...
It's R2-D3.
No. My hint for all of you, including Phil Plate, the hint is the answer is not as simple as it sounds. So if you think you know the answer to this week's Who's That Noisy, or if you'd like to send me in a suggestion, please email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. May the force be with you always.
Thank you, Jay.
Oh, it is.
All right, one quick question this week. This comes from Maurice Fitzgerald from Geneva, Switzerland. And Maurice writes, Solar panels suck up all the sun's energy, cause cancer, etc. This one seems too ridiculous to be a true story, but since it is in North Carolina, you never know. He links to a story that's been – this one's been going around the internet, you know, for the last couple of days. A U.S. town rejects solar panels amid fears they suck up all the energy from the sun.
Those are some impressive solar panels, if that's the case.
Yeah, so this is one of those things. We even linked to this from our Facebook page, but this is one of those stories where it's the narrative's a little bit too good to be true. You know what I mean? So it's also a little bit too on the nose from a skeptical point of view. You know, digging a little deeper, it seems that it's been wildly misreported. This is pretty much a standard NIMBY issue. I used the term NIMBY last week. If you don't know what that means, it stands for not in my backyard.
Right.
And it's the general phenomenon that people, even if they might be for solar energy or for windmills or for nuclear power, or we understand that we need federal prisons or whatever, they just don't want one near their house, you know, or in their neighborhood. And it often comes down to property values, right? Quality of life, property values. So the local townsfolks, and of course there's always some nut job in there, but that aside, but the local townsfolk, what they object to is a huge field, a solar farm that they are afraid is going to adversely affect their property values. That's what it comes down to. Then, of course, you know, they try to come up with anything they can think of. Now, the idea of sucking up all the energy, I think that was taken out of context. I don't think anyone was suggesting that it's sucking up any energy other than what's directly hitting it. Obviously, when you put an array of solar panels down, the ground underneath it is getting shaded, and so no plants are going to be growing underneath the solar panels. The most dubious objection that was raised was by one of the local residents who said that you can't convince me that solar panels don't cause cancer.
Okay.
If you ever hear yourself saying those words, you can't convince me.
Yeah.
Just stop right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
pretty much.
Yeah, just got to be very careful about that because you're basically saying that you're immune to evidence. You could always be convinced. It may take a huge amount of evidence, but you know, I would try never to express things in that way.
That's the real definition of close-mindedness.
Yeah, by definition. But in any case, there's no evidence linking solar panels to cancer. The only real concern is in the current panels may include metals like mercury and whatnot that when it comes time to replace them, you know, where are they going to go? So where are they going to go in the landfill? This is part of the problem with existing technology, both batteries and solar panels, that when you're considering their environmental and economic feasibility, you have to consider everything, you know, soup to nuts, which includes obtaining the materials to make them and also where they go when their life cycle is over. I think that what this was is it was a local issue, you know, where the people didn't want to have the solar panel in their backyard. And some of their objections were overblown or taken out of context.
I guess, yeah, makes sense.
Well, guys, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. This is, guys, this is the last regular episode of the year.
Holy shit.
That's right.
That's the fastest year of my life.
This is the last episode of 2015. Next week's show is going to be the year-end wrap-up, which is going to be a lot of fun. So, for the last science or fiction of the year, and I think I've done this before, I picked three science news items that we may have missed throughout the year.
Okay.
Bob. You prepped for this one, Bob,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So these are not recent news items. They're news items that I just from the year that maybe we didn't talk about. All right. Item number one. In May, scientists announced that they had discovered the first fish to be entirely endothermic or warm-blooded. Item number two, a paper published in July provides evidence for early cultivation of plants 11,000 years before the accepted beginning of agriculture 12,000 years ago. And item number three, scientists have developed a mesh that can separate bacteria from any fluid, including blood, which can be used to treat infections. Bob, I think you complained first, so you get to go first this week.
And I was thinking that this whole time. Like, don't complain. Bob, don't pull a Rebecca.
Mute is your friend.
Don't complain, because he will pick on me.
All right, an endothermic fish.
What?
Oh, I don't know. I could, let's go to two, shall we? Cultivation of plants 11,000 years before the beginning of agriculture. I mean, maybe small scale, really small scale, and it didn't take off. I mean, so yeah, I could, yeah, potentially I could see that, or maybe that's what you want me to think. So now we've got a mesh that can separate bacteria from any fluid. Oh, wow. Including blood.
Oh, wow.
So you got the right size, and either they'll slip through or they won't. Wow, that's really a fascinating idea. Put the blood through it. And what you got left? Oh, wow. I mean, I'm going to go with the warm-blooded. I don't know. I'll say that's fiction. Whatever.
Okay, Evan?
The first fish to be entirely endothermic. Entirely endothermic. I wonder, where would a fish like this exist? It would probably have to be in a pretty cold place. And maybe it's one of those deep, deep critters that they discovered. It's very cold down there. So I think that one's actually going to wind up being the science bub. Then the next one about the plants. 11,000 years before the accepted beginning. So we're 11, 12. So we're talking 23,000 years ago?
Yep.
Well, maybe it was small scale, like you said, Bob, or something very little pockets or something. Yeah, certainly not nothing like it would be today. Which means the last one, this mesh that can separate bacteria from any fluid, including blood. That's impressive. And used to treat infections at the same time. I'm having a hard time figuring that one out. Well, but, you know, that they developed the mesh, I don't think is all that. But I'm not sure that they really got this whole separating of the bacteria and treating the infections kind of all in one. It seems like a panacea of sorts. So I'll say that that one's the fiction.
And Jay,
the first fish to be endothermic. I think that that is perfectly cromulent. Why not? Sure, there's so many different kinds of species of fish out there. Why couldn't one be warm-blooded? The second item here, which is about the early cultivation of plants that happening 11,000 years prior to when we thought it was actually happening. That's a lot of time. But again, all right, that's certainly plausible. I could see them finding evidence that would prove that. So as we get to the third one here, this mesh that can separate bacteria from any fluid, including blood, I think that one is the fiction for a number of reasons. One, because I suspect that blood would coagulate in the mesh, which would make it so that, you know, that'd make it a horrible mess. And I don't think, yes, that's number one. Number two, I don't think the mesh could capture bacteria. So I'm going to say that one's a fiction.
Okay. So you all agree on the second one. So we'll start there. A paper published in July provides evidence for early cultivation of plants 11,000 years before the accepted beginning of agriculture 12,000 years ago. Evan, you correctly deduced that that means it was 23,000 years ago. Congratulations.
Yes.
Yes.
You got to look for the little victories.
You all think that this one is science and this one is science.
Oh boy.
See?
This one is really fascinating. So yeah, so agriculture developed 12,000 years ago. That's pretty clear that it became widespread. The evidence for that is pretty overwhelming that we started living in locations, not moving around and actually cultivating wild plants and domesticating animals. Yeah, that's pretty clear. However, archaeologists digging around in Israel found evidence that maybe even 11,000 years. Think about 11,000 years of
earlier,
essentially static technology, you know?
Oh.
So the first inkling of cultivation was occurring 11,000 years before they actually developed full-blown agriculture. That's a long time.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
But what they found, there's so much stuff going on in this study. So one thing is that, and something I did not realize until I read this study, that weeds specifically evolved to take advantage of agriculture, of human agriculture. Did you know that?
Oh, wow.
They obviously have wild ancestors, but they evolved. They adapted to take advantage of the changes that humans made to the environment, you know, basically agriculture. And those are the plants that are now weeds. you know, that disrupt our crops. So they could look at the weeds to see whether or not any agriculture was going on. Think about that.
Oh, cool.
So what they found in this area, first of all, they found that the humans were eating the wild counterparts to all of this of the same modern plants that we're eating today.
Yeah, but they were crap back then.
Yeah, they were. They were crap back then, but not so much the grains. They were just not as productive, but they were eating wild wheat and wild barley, for example. Yeah, so some of the foods were as edible as they are now. They just weren't as productive.
Okay.
A lot of the vegetables were inedible, you know, or barely edible that we take, and fruits the same way. A lot of them were barely edible, the ones that we take for granted now. But in any case, they were eating a lot of the same foods that we eat today, just the wild versions of them, not the cultivated versions. But they found evidence that there was actually some cultivation going on and that the weeds were already adapting to what little, and you're right, Bobby, was isolated. And it never took off. At least there's no evidence at this point. Maybe this did simmer along for a while. Who knows? But it's possible that they tried it for a while and whatever, just culturally, it never took hold. It's also possible that it just took a really long time before it got to the point where, you know, it had a huge, it spread as a huge change in society, as an agricultural revolution.
It took a while for it to reach critical mass of, you know, productivity and efficiency.
Yeah, maybe they were cultivating the plants, and they had to get to a certain point before it was worthwhile, you know, giving up. The question was, when did they get to the point where they basically abandoned the hunter-gatherer lifestyle for an agricultural lifestyle? Even if they were doing a little bit of agriculture, it wasn't enough to abandon their hunter-gatherer lifestyle, which means they would be nomadic. Still, they would need to, you know, follow the herds that they were hunting, for example. And so you kind of have to do one or the other. All right, let's go back to number one. In May, scientists announced that they had discovered that the first fish to be entirely endothermic or warm-blooded. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Jay and Evan, you think this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, Bob. The fish is the opa, not Oprah, but opa, O-P-A-H. Lampris guttatus. Lampris guttatus.
Lampris, as in light.
It's a very large fish. It's almost round, you know, from the side. It's basically the size and almost the shape of a manhole cover. Think about that. But with fins and, you know, a fish head. It's a big fish. Very pretty, actually. And they knew that parts of it were warm-blooded, but the new discovery was that it's entirely warm-blooded. And that's, I guess there are other fish that have some tissues that maintain their body temperature, but this showed that the fish as a whole maintains its body temperature. They found blood vessels in the gills, for example, that would be used for temperature regulation that you only see in warm-blooded creatures. They said that this would be adaptive, that this would give, this is a predator, this fish is a predator, and the warm-bloodedness would give it an advantage over its prey in the colder climates. This is also a fish species that is found in many different locations around the world. It has a very large range. And when you get into some of the deeper and colder waters, being warm-blooded would make you faster. It could make you have quicker reaction times. And so that would give it a it would be able to see better, apparently. So it would have a distinct advantage over its prey. So that was very interesting. The first warm-blooded fish. Who knew? Very cool. And we totally missed that news item. I don't remember that from
earlier
in the year.
I remember it.
Do you?
Yep.
Bastard.
Good, wow, there you good go. For okay. you. All right. You went which last. Means that scientists have developed a mesh that can separate bacteria from any fluid, including blood, which can be used to treat infections, is fiction. Evan, I think the thing that you were having problem with here is that if it's separating out bacteria from the blood, what about the red and white blood cells, or even the fibrinogen? You know, and the platelets. You know, there's.
Well, I have a hard time in my head remembering the scale of all these.
There's lots of stuff in the blood, things. A lot bigger than bacteria. That would be the real problem.
Yeah, see, I don't have that at the top of my.
Yeah, yeah.
The top of my
that
head.
There are cells the in your blood. Things. Yeah. Oh, the scale.
No.
Bacteria are tiny. They're small compared to eukaryotic cells. Only and viruses, or most viruses. There are huge viruses, but most are smaller than bacteria. Anyway, this is loosely based on a real news item. What the mesh that was developed this year by Ohio State University is a stainless steel mesh that separates oil from water. So the holes allow water to pass through, but it's coated with a lipophobic substance, so a substance that would repel oil. So the oil gets repelled and the water passes through. When fully developed, this is just a, you know, they did a proof of concept. If they could develop this into a way of, for example, treating oil spills in the ocean.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, just, you know, drag the oil out and leave the water behind.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah. All right. Well, good job, Jay and Evan.
Of course.
So that was it. That's the last show. That's the last science fiction of the year.
Oh, wow. That's it. Oh, my God. So we got to know the stats.
We got to get the stats. Yeah. We got to get the stats.
Oh, boy.
Okay, Evan, give us the quote of the week.
Science should always be impartial in its application, and it is vital for administrators to affirm they believe in the scientific process and in transparency and accountability. Spoken by Kirsty Duncan, she is the new science minister of Canada.
Yeah, apparently an excellent choice. I think people are generally happy with her as a choice for the science minister. It's a well said quote. It's obviously very, very true. Transparency and accountability. It's not the most inspirational quote that you could imagine about science. It's not, you know, Sagan-esque or Neil deGrasse Tyson-esque. It's, you know, but it's from the science minister. I guess it's appropriate.
Yeah. And it's to the point. And it's, you know, we concentrate on the more glowing and flowery or, you know,
poetic,
beautiful, poetic sort of quotes. But this one really just drives home the point that these are very important things we must remember.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, Steve.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Steve.
See you soon.
Yeah, we'll see you soon. When this show is going up, we will have seen Star Wars, and we'll be recording our review. We'll be recording our review, and then we'll be doing the year-end wrap-up show. So I really look forward to doing that.
That'll be fun.
That'll be a lot of fun. And until next week, this
may the force be with you.
This is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.